Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Edgar Bronfman grew up with a version of Judaism he found uninspiring and closed. Now at 79, the prominent Jewish leader and philanthropist knows that Jews are worried about their children drifting away from the faith. He says it's time for a Jewish renaissance based on hope and inclusiveness, not fear of anti-Semitism or intermarriage. Not everyone agrees. This hour on Point, Edgar Bronfman's call to Jews for hope, not fear. You can join the conversation at just 2% of the U.S. population. Can the Jewish community afford to open its doors and welcome all comers? Can it afford not to? Joining me now from New York is Edgar Bronfman, prominent Jewish philanthropist and leader, and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Bill Clinton in 1999. Born and raised in his native Canada, he was CEO of Seagram Company for 23 years and president of the World Jewish Congress until last year. His new book, written with Beth Zasloff, is Hope, Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance. Edgar Bronfman, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
You say fear has been the sort of defining motivation and identifying a pole for a long time, was for a long time, maybe deserved for a long time, but not now. What now?
Well, I think it's time to put our terrible history behind us and look forward to a very bright future. And I think that anti-Semitism is virtually gone in the United States and Canada. And it's certainly time for us to look to expanding our numbers, because otherwise we're going to slowly drift away. And I don't think that's a good idea.
Rosh Hashanah next week, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur, high holidays right in front of us. As Jews celebrate these holidays, what's the message, what's the sort of path that you describe here? Hope Not Fear is a big, broad statement. What does it mean inside? Unpack it for us.
Well, what I'm looking forward to is a big, wide, open tent where everybody who wants to be Jewish can be Jewish. And as our famous sage Hillel said, when asked to describe the entire Bible standing on one leg, he simply said, don't do anything else that's abominable to anybody else. The rest is commentary. Now go study. What he meant was, I think, come into the tent and then study and see if you like our morals and our ethics.
A big, wide-open tent, but Judaism has not been historically an evangelizing faith or community. Are you saying change that, or, you know, go out and actually, muster up new Jews, or just be open when and if they come? What is it?
Well, I think it's not just open. I think what you have to be is very welcoming when our youth marry non-Jews. After all, we're not marrying pagans. We all believe in the same God. It's simply a matter of which path. And I think that if we are very welcoming, there's a good chance that their children will be brought up Jewish. And I think that's, you know, important that we increase our size, because otherwise we're going to disappear.
You know that depending on what strand of Judaism they follow, you know very well, not everyone's going to agree with that. What kind of response do you get to that call for a more open Jewish community, and particularly to interfaith marriage couples?
Well, it doesn't really make very much difference what kind of response I get, because we have to deal with the facts. And the facts are that at colleges across the United States, close to 50% of all those who say they're Jewish come from one Jewish parent family. Mm. So that's the fact. So that's what we have to deal with. It's not an ideal world.
You know, there's been this phrase, silent Holocaust, has been used, and not at all to mock the Holocaust, but to look at what's happened to numbers of Jews and identification with the Jewish faith and culture in recent years. Jews worried about young Jews falling away from the path or in intermarriage, that leading to diminishing interest to their children or grandchildren not being Jewish at all. Are you not worried about that?
Of course I'm worried about it. But I think the answer to it is not to scream and shout about intermarriage when it's taking place anyway, but to use it to our advantage and to be totally welcoming, warmly welcoming to those who marry into our faith.
Let's put that on one side for a second. It raises all kinds of interesting questions about doctrine and orthodoxy. You also say anti-Semitism is, as you describe it, kind of outdated as the fight against anti-Semitism, outdated as an organizing principle. You devoted a lot of your own life, though, to that very effort. What's brought you to this new perspective?
Well, the facts brought me to that new perspective. If you take a look at the election of 2000, Gore, though he won, lost. And nobody blamed it on the fact that his vice presidential running mate was a Jew named Joe Lieberman. Mm. So, you know, you have to say, well, you know, if that's the case, then obviously anti-Semitism is not a factor in the United States and Canada. When I spent my whole life fighting anti-Semitism, it was mostly the Holocaust and its aftermath.
But Jews for centuries have, as you write in the book Hope Not Fear, have defined themselves in part by a struggle against persecution, by wrestling with anti-Semitism. If that's not there, does it take away part of the historic glue of this very community?
Yes, I think that's part of the problem. If you're not being persecuted, then there's less tendency to pass on the Judaism. But, you know, when talking about North America, mm-hmm. when our ancestors came here, they didn't come here to be better Jews. They came here to have a better life. And they just assumed that their children would remain Jewish as they had, because that was what the others wouldn't let them be otherwise. Now that's changed. They're so nice to us, they want to marry us. Well, we have to face that fact and not find enemies behind every post.
You say the problem is not that Jews are falling in love with non-Jews, but that they aren't falling in love with Judaism. What would you do about that?
Well, I think that has to do with a certain amount of education. I think it's pretty hard to fall in love with something you know nothing about. And I think we've erred on the side of letting strangers teach our children what Judaism is. That's certainly what happened to me in my childhood. And my biggest regret is that I didn't have a Jewish home for my children. I was lucky. I've got a lot of Jewish grandchildren. But what we have to do is we have to have families who will do Friday night, and I say this very sincerely in my book, they have to create a Jewish home. Without a Jewish home, Judaism is going to perish. With a Jewish home, it can thrive.
Are you also saying you've got to have then Jewish schools for the children of Jewish families or interfaith families? How far does the focus on Jewish culture, Jewish education need to go to at the same time be open but keep the heart of the culture, community, faith vibrant enough to hold?
Well, I think there are going to be different strokes for different folks. I think that some people will want day schools for their children. The secret to that is that they have to be better than every other school. We have to pay teachers more, and we have to get better teachers in our day schools. And I've advocated as far back as 1994 that every Jewish child that should want to should be able to go to a Jewish day school regardless of cost. And that means a great reordering of priorities amongst Jewish charities.
So real financial resource reordering of priorities.
Yes.
What do you see as standing in the way or in opposition to this shift, evolution that you're describing here? What in traditional teaching, what in traditional custom do you see as the barriers to the path that you describe?
Well, there are barriers because there are lots who are going to say, you know, you have to be Orthodox and you have to do and you have to do this and you have to do that and keep kosher, etc. There are others who are going to say, you know, thank God somebody's saying it now because he's dealing with the facts as they appear. I'm not concerned with those who don't agree with me. I'm really want to be a champion, if I can, of those who realize that the facts are what they are and we have to deal with them.
Are you at all worried that, you know, you could make a good faith effort at this, open the doors, pump up the emphasis on teaching and celebration of the faith, and at the end of it, whatever that might mean, find that without a kind of exclusivity, without some walls, without constant reminders of the persecution of the past, that you lose numbers or lose cohesion in the Jewish community.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, but I would like to replace that with joy. I would like to have a kind of religion that I think we really are, which is a joyous one, which is very celebratory. The only non-celebratory holiday we have is called Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the month of Ab, which commemorates not only the destruction of two temples, the first and the second, but also a lot of other things, including the exodus from Spain. I really think that even Yom Kippur can be a very joyous day if you realize that what you've done for the last 10 days, if you try to change yourself and make yourself into a better person, and you vow to not sin any longer, at least to try to restore yourself to a better, higher plane. And that's joyous.
We're going to open the lines to phones when we come back. We'll also hear other perspectives on the air with you. Edgar Bronfman, what kind of response are you getting to the big message, hope not fear, open the doors? Are people cocking their eyebrows and saying, are you kidding? Or are Jews in your circle ready for this?
Well, I think they're more than ready. I think that the response I've heard so far has been excellent. I want to sell a lot of books, not because I need the money, but because I want a lot of people to study the situation. And I'm not being antagonistic when I say this. I don't tell everybody what they have to do. I just think that if we want to stay as a relevant people in North America, then we have to do what I'm suggesting.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jewish leader and philanthropist Edgar Bronfman about his call for a new Jewish posture in the world. He calls it in his new book, Hope, Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance. He wants to focus on optimism more than anti-Semitism and put out the welcome mat for interfaith families and bring Jewish youth to a deeper understanding of their faith. The book is Hope Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance. Edgar Bronfman joins us from New York, and let's take a call from Brattleboro, Vermont. Ely, you're on the air with Edgar Bronfman.
Yeah, hi, Tom. First of all, I just want to say awesome show.
Thank you. Love it. Thank you.
My comment really is I'm all for intermarriage and acculturation, I would say, which is what I think Edgar is promoting here, positive acculturation. But even I am a little bit afraid of the negative aspect, which is assimilation of the Jews into just regular American society, because I think in any situation when Jews feel too comfortable and too accepted, they lose that Jewish identity and become part of the major thing, which is what happened to the Jews in Denmark after the Holocaust, when their Gentile neighbors helped save them and they returned, and now there are really no more Jews left. They're an incredibly small percentage because they just assimilated into the Denmark society.
Eli, stand by. Edgar Bronfman, here's a young supporter who says, great idea, let's be open, but at the same time, you hear the fear that he expresses, and he's part of the generation relatively comfortable with what you're describing. What do you say to him?
Well, I think he's partially right. There is a danger of assimilation, but we're having that anyway. So what we really have to do is we have to try to counter the assimilation by letting our youth know what a great faith we have. One of the things that I love so much about Judaism is the fact that our Talmud tells us to ask questions. So we're not really a religion of faith. We're a religion of texts. And our texts really are based on ethics and on morals. And if we get that across to everybody, and especially our youth, I think that the danger of assimilation will dissipate. But obviously some people will. That's been happening all through our history. People have gotten out of the ghettos and assimilated. If they're doing it now in much larger numbers, I think the way to stop the numbers from increasing and get them to decrease is to teach them about the beauties and the joy of Judaism.
Eli, what are you seeing among your friends, your circle? I don't know if you're married or your friends are, but if they have interfaith marriages, are those, are they going with their kids to temple, or are they drifting away?
Well, I think a lot of my experience with interfaith is from cousins with interfaith marriages, and largely it's those that have married Gentile spouses. I mean, they stay with the Jewish traditions because of their family, and that's what their family is doing, not because of any real faith of their own. And honestly, I would say I'm kind of a product of that assimilation also, because you say, what do I see among my friends? And most of my friends are Gentile, and I have very few Jewish friends just because of the towns that I've grown up with and stuff like that. I mean, I identify strongly with my Jewish faith, but I just don't have friends who do. So,
In part, some of that is just what it means to be Jewish in America, I guess, though many paths there. Eli, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Robin in Arlington, Massachusetts. Robin, you're on the air.
Lashana Tova. Happy holidays.
Same to you.
I don't agree with your message that anti-Semitism is dead, but I agree 100% with your way of fighting it. I belong to a liberal reform temple. We welcome everybody. We've got gay couples. We have single moms with adopted children from all over the world. We have lots of interfaith couples. And we're growing. We're starting to run out of room for our Hebrew school and for our lovely little shul. And we're helping people create Jewish homes. It's an unbelievable community. And so there's a lot of positive going out there that is going to be what's going to fight any anti-Semitism, any hate. Creating joyful Jewish homes is the way to do it.
But anti-Semitism still really a problem or not then, Robin, in your experience?
It definitely is. It is even in local communities. We're not talking about looking at things from around the world. We're talking about right here issues that our children have fought in the schools and in their towns. The way to give them the armor for that is to remind them who they are and that they have a strong community around them, and to feel really good about who they are, not to apologize, not to be afraid. And the only way to do that is to bring the kind of joyous, welcoming, exciting, vibrant Jewish community that we need right now.
Edgar Bronfman, it sounds as though Robin's pretty nearly on the same page as you there. Of course, not every temple is so open and accepting.
Well, that's unfortunate. I wish they all were like, but Robin is talking about something which I think is absolutely necessary in this world of ours, and that's Jewish pride. And she wants her children and the children, all the children in her community to be proud of being Jewish. And I think that's a very, very wonderful point, and I'm glad she made it.
You write in your book, Hope Not Fear, that you learn from your son Adam. On the other hand, it can be pretty tough, insulting, if your children from interfaith marriage are considered not to be Jews by other Jews.
Yes, that did happen. The result of it was rather interesting. His oldest son, my grandson Josh, asked his father about having a tattoo, and his father said, "Well, it's really up to you." And he put a tattoo on himself, and it's a Magen David with a hand in the middle. He's wearing his Judaism very proudly, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. It wasn't my idea, it was his idea.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may. Sylvia Fishman joins us, a professor of American Jewish Sociology at Brandeis University, author of Double or Nothing, Jewish Families and Mixed Marriages. Sylvia Fishman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be talking with you.
It's great to have you. You hear Edgar Bronfman's big call. His catchphrase is hope, not fear. He says, let's put anti-Semitism to the side a bit in North America. Jews can afford to do it in this culture. And let's throw the doors pretty much wide open to interfaith marriage. What do you make of the call, Sylvia?
Well, I agree with many of the things that Edgar Bronfman says. I'm a big admirer of much of his work. But I agree that we have to look at the facts. But the facts are not exactly as they've been portrayed this morning. Fear is certainly not a way of reinforcing Jewish identification and Jewish life in America, because we're really lucky to be living in an open society. But what has happened in America is really unprecedented in Jewish history. In America, not only have American Jews brought American values and behaviors into their concept of Judaism, but a lot of Jewish culture has become part of America. And as a result, the Jewish community sometimes isn't very distinctive from the broader American culture, especially liberal broader American culture. We know from looking at history that ethnic groups, religious ethnic groups, survive when they are a small minority if they can manage to maintain their distinctiveness. So while it certainly is a great idea to be welcoming to all kinds of Jewish households, unless we also focus on being distinctive, assimilation can be a real threat.
So, but what are you saying with that? That Jews, in spite of the fact of being relatively welcomed, relatively, as you say, in an unprecedented position given the persecution they've known in many other countries and times, that they have to, play act, that they're still persecuted? And
oh, no. I think that we're really lucky in America that in many locations, although not all locations, anti-Semitism doesn't affect the daily life of Jews. Mm-hmm. It certainly still affects the daily life of Jews in many European settings, in many South American settings, and American Jews do not live on an island. They're very concerned about Jews around the world. So I think it's disingenuous to act as though anti-Semitism is not still a threat. But it's not a threat to most American Jews in their daily lives. I'm saying that what we need to do in order to increase our distinctiveness is to enrich what I'm going to call our cultural capital. When we look at ethnic groups that survive despite being a minority, we see that they have distinctive languages, distinctive religious rituals and ceremonies, distinctive texts and literature, distinctive family styles and values, distinctive community behavior, distinctive food, music, culture, and customs, and also a belief that they belong to a people and that they share a history, a land, and a destiny. And it's by teaching young American Jews so that they can become engaged with their own heritage that we will be able to increase our cultural capital. That's what I'm recommending.
Edgar Bronfman, how do you hear that? Can American Jews, Canadian Jews, hold themselves apart from the mainstream in the ways that Sylvia describes and still achieve the kind of openness that you're prescribing?
Well, I don't think she's describing keeping ourselves in ghettos. I think what she's describing is what I really am urging in the book is more education of Jews so they understand who they are and what they represent. And I applaud her for what she said. I think it's wonderful.
What about this central issue then, Professor Fishman, of interfaith marriage? Edgar Bronfman says, look, we're in an open society. People are going to fall in love. It's going to happen. You better throw the tent open to everybody and make everyone welcome there, or you're going to have people falling away from the community.
Okay, so this is probably where he and I do part ways somewhat. It's not true that intermarriage affects everyone in the American Jewish community equally. Different groups are much more affected by intermarriage. And one thing that we see, which is quite interesting, is that where there are two Jewish parents, three-quarters of those children marry Jews. I'm talking about recent marriages. I'm not talking about 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's only one Jewish parent, three-quarters of those children will marry non-Jews, and only 13% of their children will identify as Jews. We also see differences in the amount of intermarriage where people have a lot of Jewish friends. One of the callers before mentioned that he doesn't have a lot of Jewish friends. It turns out that peer groups are a very, very important factor in who your friends are going to be and who you're going to marry. So putting Jewish young people in an environment where they have lots of Jewish friends turns out to be an important strategy if we want to reinforce Jewish life. The concern about these issues is not the result of racism or insensitivity to individual feelings or not understanding love or not understanding personal choice. It's being aware that when you have one Jew and one non-Jew in a household, there will be two religious ethnic stories that are being told, two narratives. And children who grow up in those households, even if their parents say that they're raising them as Jews, very often feel quite free to experiment with different religious traditions when they become teenagers and they start moving away from the household. So intermarriage really is a matter to be concerned about. That doesn't mean that I'm not advocating being inclusive and welcoming. I am. But I think that the American Jewish community has to be not afraid to encourage in marriage and to encourage conversion. Households where both parents feel themselves to be Jews, either because they were born Jews or they converted into Judaism, are much, much more likely to transmit Jewish culture to the next generation.
Edgar Bronfman, is that the message you're trying to convey here?
Well, yes and no. I think that there have to be different strokes for different folks. We all can't advocate doing the same thing. It is not necessarily two stories if a Jew marries a non-Jew. It's not necessarily a Christmas tree at Hanukkah time. That sometimes happens, but not just as often it doesn't happen. I think that the statistics, and I've heard lots and read lots of statistics, and of course I've met Mrs. Fishman. We actually had a meeting on, I interviewed her. I think that the most important thing is the fact that they want to bring up their children Jewish. I have a son, as you mentioned him, Adam, mm-hmm. and his wife, they got married. They are 21 and 20. They're still married. Mm. When they came to town to have children, they decided what religion they were going to have in the house. Adam cared that it would be Jewish, and she didn't care. She's Catholic. She didn't care about that. Mm-hmm. So she became, for all intents and purposes, Jewish and had a Jewish household. She eventually converted, but that was 3 years ago or 2.5 years mm-hmm. ago. It really had, it was her own personal decision, but in the meantime, she'd had a Jewish house her whole entire career as a mother. So I think you can't draw rules and regulations. I think that a rabbi should be free to marry a Jew and a non-Jew if he's convinced they're going to bring up the children Jewish. And after all, our rabbis do have that kind of openness and to be able to make a decision, and I think I would leave it at that.
And yet, Sylvia Fishman, there are a lot of rules and regulations and pretty stern doctrines out there around marriage and definitions of who's a Jew and who's not.
In different wings of Judaism, of course, there are different approaches. In the Reform movement, rabbis are free to choose to marry Jews and non-Jews or not, as they wish. I would add a line to what Edgar Bronfman just said. I think that rabbis should also be free not to marry Jews and non-Jews if that goes against their sense of Jewish integrity. Actually, if you look at what's been happening in the Reform movement recently, it's just the opposite. Many younger Reform rabbis say that if they have principled objections to marrying a Jew and a non-Jew, they can't find a job. It's actually been a litmus test in many congregations. Only rabbis who are willing to perform intermarriages get hired. So I think that what's going on in the American Jewish community now is that in the liberal community, it's no longer considered transgressive or going against the rules to marry a Jew and a non-Jew. It's considered transgressive or going against the communal norms if you refuse to marry a Jew and a non-Jew.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jewish leader and philanthropist Edgar Bronfman, longtime head of the World Jewish Congress, about his call for a new Jewish posture in the world. He calls it in his new book, Hope, Not Fear, The Path to Jewish Renaissance. Sylvia Fishman joins us as well, professor of American Jewish Sociology at Brandeis University, author of Double or Nothing, Jewish Families and Mixed Marriage. Right now from Wilmot, New Hampshire, we have Sidra on the line. Hi, Sidra. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Edgar and Sylvia. It's a pleasure to be part of this conversation. And I first want to say that I fully embrace Edgar's initiative. It's high time We've had other expressions of this, but I hope that your book will find a very wide audience. I want to address this in three dimensions, as a teacher, as a scholar, and as a personal, as part of my personal life.
What do you teach, Sidra?
I teach comparative literature and comparative Jewish literature at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
I divide my life between Wilmot, New Hampshire, and Jerusalem, Israel.
That's more than bicoastal.
I live a very inclusive life, I suppose you could say, but certainly but more than one culture. And as a teacher, I only want to mention one anecdote. I taught recently at Duke University, and I had two different students who came to me. One identified himself as a cashew, and the other as a mushu.
What?
And they weren't studying cooking. They were, one had a Jewish and a Muslim parent, and one had a Jewish and a Catholic parent. And in each case, they were searching at the college level for some entry into their own cultural heritage. We meet this all the time, even at the Hebrew University, although most of our students, of course, are Jewish. But I want to say, as a scholar of Jewish literature and Jewish culture, I first of all embrace much of what my colleague Sylvia Fishman has said, but I believe that cultural capital is not located only in its distinctiveness or only in its boundaries. On the contrary, we know many cultures that have disappeared that have been very distinctive. I think that Jewish culture historically has survived and has flourished and been enriched most in the periods in which it's actively engaged in its environments, such as in the early centuries of the Common Era, the Hellenistic period, 12th century Spain, 19th century Germany, and, of course, 20th century America.
What does that mean here and now for marriages, let's say, in the U.S. then, Sidra?
I just want to say personally that I raised all three of my children in Israel. They're all grown now.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the three have married non-Jews and are very happily married. The third is the jury's still out. But I fully, fully embrace Edgar's initiative because I've seen the difference between hope and fear in our politics, in our culture, and certainly in the personal lives. And I have had many arguments, including, I must say, with Reform rabbis who will perform commitment ceremonies for gays and lesbians, but not for Jews and non-Jews. And that certainly goes for the conservative and the Orthodox we don't even have to talk about. But
what about your grandchildren then, Sidra? If and when you have grandchildren, and I pray that you have just as many as everybody wants.
I'm having trouble hearing you, Tom.
Do you expect your grandchildren will be Jewish?
I don't have grandchildren. Well, I have one grandchild. And right now my daughter and son-in-law and my granddaughter live in Jerusalem, and they, of course, observe all the holidays because they're living in Jerusalem and the holidays are there and they're very much a part of the family. My son, who married a German from an industrialist German family who were somewhat tainted during the Nazi period, the children have, I think, embodied the reconciliation of the two cultures, of Jewish and non-Jewish, of German and Israeli, and they, God willing, when they have children, have committed to raising their children Jewish. But my son once told me that he could not ask his wife to convert, and I fully believe in his own conviction, because a conversion means, and we know this, in all of its forms, basically repudiating where you came from, repudiating what Sylvia called your story, even in Orthodox forms, your own parents. And that seems to me to be inhuman and psychologically untenable. And I think that children raised with the wealth of cultural possibility can only contribute not only to their own health, but to the health of Jewish society. Mm. But let's not forget that Moses married out. You know, the Bible is full of men taking women from other tribes, and that those are the most culturally enriching periods in our history. And if the alternative, as we've seen, is ghettoization, parochialization, increasingly ritualized definition of Judaism, and the way they inform politics, particularly in Israel, I think that of the two alternatives, there's only one alternative that's really attractive. I'm not saying everyone should marry out. I'm saying we should welcome all those who want to join this particular celebration and they will only contribute to it.
Sidra, thank you very much for your call. Edgar Bronfman, there's a big affirmation from Sidra.
But at the same time,
you no doubt are, but Sylvia Fishman says, yes, great, but she says the numbers show that in these marriages you will have fewer children who end up identifying as Jewish.
Well, that's based on certain statistics which I don't buy, because those statistics don't come from humanities that have been really, really welcoming. I can, everybody can have their own story. I've got a nephew who married a non-Jewish girl. He lives in Montreal, and she's French-Canadian and partially Asian. And they converted. She converted, and he went to school with her, went to visit the rabbi when she was having her lessons. What I have now is two educated Jews. As before, I had one not very educated Jew and one non-Jew. So their children, and I have three of them now, are all very Jewish and brought up in a Jewish home. And that's what's important, is the Jewish home.
Sylvia Fishman, our caller, Sidra, professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and says, let's remember, there have been plenty of very distinctive cultures who have themselves kind of blinked out of existence. Distinctiveness alone, no guarantee.
Sure, but we know that distinctiveness makes it a lot more likely that the culture will be able to be transmitted from one generation to the next when it's a tiny minority. I would like to respond to Sidra's very pithy Moses married out statement and everything that goes with it. Sidra and I actually were in Camp Ramah together when we were 15 years old,
oh.
As well as being colleagues today.
It goes way back then.
Way back, yeah. The Jewish cultures, which were very interactive with outside cultures, which certainly happened throughout Jewish history, were cultures that were themselves extremely rich and extremely distinctively Jewish, so that when you have Jews in the Golden Age of Spain absorbing so much from Arabic culture and then from Christian culture, they made it Jewish. They incorporated it into Jewish life because they had all of those landmarks of Jewish culture that I mentioned, Jewish languages, ritual, ceremonies, texts, literature, family, all of those things. So that they were able to incorporate things from the outside into Jewish culture and Judaize it, make it their own. In America today, things are different because the vast majority of Jews have a very thin acquaintance with Jewish culture. And so when they interact with the non-Jewish culture around them, rather than Judaizing it, they end up very often further diluting their Jewish surroundings, their Jewish pith, their Jewish core. Even in terms of the marriage issue, during the biblical period, as Shia Cohn and other biblical scholars have shown us, when Jewish men married non-Jewish women, those women became part of Jewish culture. There was no formal way to convert at that time. It was assumed in ancient tribal cultures that the woman would become part of the man's tribal heritage. Mm. That wasn't saying very much about the feminism of those times, because men really determined the culture. Nowadays, as Edgar talked about the converting into Judaism, it's some of our most passionate and committed Jews are Jews by choice. That's very true. But I think we need to distinguish between Jews by choice, who are real Jews, and households which are intermarried, where there's one Jew and one non-Jew. The profile of those two different households is statistically quite different.
We have so many callers. I want to continue to get to them. Eva, calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Eva, you're on the air.
Hi. I was, in listening to the program, it seems that we're still talking about survival. It's just switched from anti-Semitism to intermarriage. And I think that Professor Fishman raised a really good point, which is that Judaism will only survive if it has something distinctive enough. The general ethical messages are liberal American messages. Joy can be found in many ways. So my question is, what is it that Judaism possesses in its teachings that will really serve what people in this very difficult world are looking for? Will help them with their personal suffering, with the suffering of the world. That's my question.
Eva, let me ask you before I put that to Edgar Bronfman and Sylvia Fishman. Are you suggesting that there's not enough, that it requires a kind of continued, you know, I don't know, circling of the wagons or something to hold it together, or that there is, but it...
No, I'm saying, I guess I'm the provocative question I'm really asking is, why should Judaism continue to survive? What does it offer to the world that is so distinctive that it needs to be preserved?
May I ask?
And I'm asking this as a Jew, as someone whose parents were refugees,
right,
as someone who feels very strongly about my own Jewish culture.
Eva, stick with us. You know, Edgar Bronfman, what do you say to Eva?
I asked that question of the very famous and distinguished Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. And he looked at me as if I was crazy, and he said, of course we should survive. We've given the world so much, and we have so much more to give. And I think that the basic tikkun olam, the being God's partners in creation, is so terribly important, and we're not doing the job we should be doing. The Jews should be standing up in every corner of the world yelling about burning fossil fuel. The Jews should be standing up everywhere about other holocausts like Darfur or like Rwanda, like Cambodia, and say never again means no holocaust ever again, not just ours. And I think this is terribly important, that we should be the moral leaders of mankind.
Sylvia, what does Eva's thought question, what does it raise in response from you?
I think she's asking exactly the right question. We all need to ask the question, why should Judaism survive? What does it matter? Why should we care? I think that actually every parent of children needs to honestly discuss that question with their children so that they can find an answer within their own selves about why Judaism matters to them. I think that there are things about Jewish culture which are unique. Last year I taught for a few weeks in China, and I discovered something which I guess I should have known, but I didn't, which was that the concept of the Sabbath, of a rest day once a week, was not part of Far Eastern culture, and it made me realize all the more that Judaism had brought the concept of Shabbat, of the rest day, of a time when servants rest, when animals rest, when you are not on your BlackBerry. We had brought that concept to the world. It still is such a valuable concept, especially in this age when most of us are tethered to our electronic devices most of the time. The concept that that Edgar Bronfman just talked about, tikkun olam, engagement in the world, Judaism as a not otherworldly religion, as a religion that focuses on our responsibilities, human responsibilities to what is going on around us, that's a profoundly Jewish concept. Another thing that he mentioned earlier, debate. It is a culture that has always emphasized asking questions, debating, arguing. That's the way Jews learn their sacred texts. They learn them by wrestling with them. And I would say that there are aspects of the Jewish life cycle, the way mourning is handled, for example, which are profoundly wise. So I think that there is much that Judaism still has, not just historically, still has to offer liberal Jews in this wonderful environment that we share.
There are so many callers we're not going to get to, I'm afraid. I should say you can read an excerpt of Edgar Bronfman's book, Hope Not Fear, at our website, onpointradio.org, and join in the conversation there. Edgar Bronfman, what stands in the way of the vision you're outlining here?
Oh, I don't think anything really stands in the way. I think habit probably stands in the way, and a certain fear of doing this. If you're going to be really welcoming, is that going to open up floodgates is this going to dilute us to a point where we don't matter? Anything that you do has a lot of fear in it. But you know, the bold lead, and then look behind them and see if anybody's following. And that's what I'm trying to do with the book. I'm trying to be bold and say, look, it's what we have been doing isn't working. Let's try something that may work. And I think it will.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us today. And to all the callers, I'm sorry we couldn't get to so many. But as I say, check out the conversation at onpointradio.org. Sylvia Fishman, professor of American Jewish Sociology at Brandeis University. Good holidays to you. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur coming up. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It was great to be part of this.
And Edgar Bronfman, joining us today from New York, was CEO of Seagram Company for a long, long time, president of the World Jewish Congress until just last year, and now co-author with of Hope Not Fear, A Path to Jewish Renaissance. Edgar Bronfman, thank you very much for joining us. Good holidays to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can join the conversation and download the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rose, and Ping Huang, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.